Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, September 18th. I'm Ray Graff. On today's program, it's the Copyright Forum, and joining us in the studio, Paul Rapp, Polly Law, and Bill Westwood. They're here to answer your questions about protecting your writing, your music, your art, your intellectual property, if you will. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You may also email us, if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Paul, Polly, Bill, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today's program is the Copyright Forum. And to answer your questions, we have our panel in the studio, most of them. Polly Law is a past president of the Graphic Artists Guild, an organization focused on the rights of artists. She is a designer, illustrator, and artist whose works are in numerous private collections and is represented by galleries in Rhinebeck, New York, along with Provincetown and Nantucket, Massachusetts. Paul Rapp is an intellectual property lawyer and writer in the Berkshires. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, and businesses involved in the creative economy. He lectures widely on intellectual property issues and wrote a column for Metroland, that late lamented Metroland. Bill Westwood may or may not be here, and if he is here, he's one of the country's leading medical illustrators, whether he's here or not, and a professional member and past president of the Association of Medical Illustrators. I'll say good afternoon to Bill as well, if he's listening. And also, Paul Rapp, welcome back.
I am back.
Nice to have you, here.
Yeah, well, at least I'm here.
And Polly Law, always good to have you here.
Thanks, Ray.
How have you guys been doing? Summer okay?
Yeah, it's winding down, which sure for me is very pleasant.
Beautiful colors to paint.
No, I don't. My day job is very busy in the summer, I'm looking forward to a long winter in the studio.
Well, that's the time. Some of that cabin fever. This one came in via email. Before we get to the phones, and I guess I should give the number. It's 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551 if you have a question about intellectual property of any kind. This one came in from Josh about an hour ago. Bill Westwood's in the house. Thank you, Zachy, the engineer. This one came in from Josh. How do we find out what images are or not in the public domain? How does one determine that? We're interested in finding images that would be made into custom jigsaw puzzles and sold, most specifically dealing with Japanese prints. We have access to a private collection of Japanese woodblock prints, most of which are 20th century reprints of older prints. Some are using the original blocks. Some are recreated using new blocks. How do we determine where the rights to those images are, if any? Does the owner of the print own these images? Any thoughts concerning this would be helpful, and that is from Josh. Hi, Bill.
Well, what do you think?
Well,
that's an interesting question.
Yeah, because the blocks themselves, the original art, is way beyond copyright.
Yeah, and is way beyond copyright, and unless they've added something significant. And how do you do that with a block? I mean, your choice of colors.
You'd have to recut the whole block.
You know, yeah. And if it's a recut block that's based on an ancient block, that's going to be in the public domain as well. I mean, you said some of them were 20th century, and you know, and I don't really know what the copyright regime in Japan was in 1940.
Okay,
if there even was one. So, I would tend to err on just go ahead.
Okay.
You know, and because it some of the questions are unanswerable, but it sounds like most of the stuff is going to be in the public domain.
Fair enough. All right. Let's welcome Bill Westwood. Hello, Bill.
Hello. Nice. Sorry I'm late.
We were concerned about you.
Thank you.
Did you get caught in traffic?
I'll explain later.
Ah. Oh, was there a good backstory?
Sort of.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's just go to the phones then. 800-348-2551 is the number. We start out with Matt in New Jersey. Matt, you're on.
Hi. My question is, I'm a do-it-yourself songwriter and publisher, and I've hired people to perform my songs, and I've paid to have it recorded and paid them to perform, and now want to include it on published works, these do-it-yourself publishing sites, and, you know, with a CD going out and putting on iTunes and the like. Do I need their permission to to do that. And this is where the person has sung and another person has played the guitar. So they're notable. But it's all my stuff, and I paid everybody to do it, but never received a work or never asked for a work for hire. And it was some years ago this occurred.
Yeah, I think you're okay. I mean, these guys were studio musicians, and you know they go in and record, and they get paid, and they have no expectation of ownership or anything on the back end. You know, if they're real professionals and they thought they were owed some of that stuff, they would have demanded some kind of contract. You know, it's not a bad idea to have a work-for-hire agreement, which can be just two sentences, and you can do it yourself and make sure you both sign it, and you can find them online. But I don't think that it's, you know, absolutely strictly necessary, given the situation as you described it.
Great. Can I ask another very quick question?
Sure.
I've just bought a new car, and I made a song about that car with a notable name and a notable manufacturer and a notable model number. And I have already published it, and it's already getting some airplay and the like. Am I at risk because I used the name, you know, this is a very known name,
nope,
blindly out there for this song?
I mean, nobody went after Ike Turner for Rocket 88. Nobody went after David Lindley for Crazy About My Mercury.
Yeah.
Or Pink Cadillac or Prince for, what am I thinking?
V8 Ford Blues, Mose Allison.
Right.
Yeah.
Great.
Prince, Little Red Corvette.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
All right, Matt. Well, good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I wonder what car it was. Look at that. Edsel.
Too late.
Okay, yeah. Let's go to Tony in North Adams. Tony, you're on.
Hi, I have a question. I don't really have anything to do with this product, but there's something called Fire Cider. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Is it S-I-D-E-R or C-I-D-E-R?
Yeah, C-I-D-E-R. So it's like
As they are my clients, I know more.
are you allowed to say anything now, legally?
We're in the middle of litigation, so.
So the question I had, I was just wondering, because I've heard like a lot about it, but I never heard any like resolution to the problem. But it's a drink that's been like homemade in all these different places. It's kind of like a country sort of thing, and it's always been called Fire Cider, and then suddenly someone decided to market this and they took that name, and it prevents anyone else from calling their product or their drink Fire Cider. So I was just wondering how does that work? It'd be like, could you like market something called apple cider all of a sudden?
I really can't say too much, but there's a whole lot of issues that are in front of the court right now as we speak, and have been for the better part of 6 months, and we're just waiting for the resolution.
Huh.
The question is whether Fire Cider is a generic term.
Exactly.
And, you know, the fact is, the legal standard for genericness is if a majority of the relevant public sees it as a generic term. And
how do you gauge that?
You have to do
market
surveys.
Research.
And we did several market surveys that showed that a very small percentage of people recognized the people that recognized the name didn't even agree on what it on what it meant. Some people thought it was a health tonic. People thought it was an alcoholic drink.
Can I ask Tony a question?
Sure.
Are you one of the plaintiffs or related in some way to the suit?
No, I mean I've actually only like tasted it one time to see what it tasted like.
Mm.
But I mean it's just like in the whole. People who are sort of like, I hate to say back to the earth or, you know, that kind of style of people. Like
the herbalist community.
And stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
There's like been a big uproar about it in that like whole community because they're saying we've used this for years and how can somebody all of a sudden come and take the name, you know? So I was just curious as to what the outcome, if there was one.
Isn't this part and parcel of the general public not understanding intellectual property? Be it trademark or copyright or...
No, I mean, they went and registered the trademark for Fire Cider.
Interesting.
The PTO granted it, and so that, you know...
But that's what I'm saying. Given the fact that these other folks are upset, they may be upset because they don't understand the concept of trademark or copyright.
Yeah, there is that, and Monopoly was a popular game among East Coast college students in 1910, 1920. And then Clarence Darrow, of all people, you know, bought the rights to it and registered the trademark. And it's been a durable trademark for decades.
Right. So. All right. Well, Tony, we have to leave it there. And thanks a lot, because Paul Rapp just got a billable hour. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. We'll be back on the Copyright Forum. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Copyright Forum. Bill, Paul, and Polly are here. I'll remember their names. I'll just write it down. Number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question about intellectual property. Let's go back to the phones. And Lewis in Wappingers Falls. Lewis, you're on.
Thank you very much. I it's kind of involved, and I'm going to try to make it as short and sweet and as clear as I can. I have an idea, and I need some help with it. It has to do with... stay with me. It's not a joke. I want to think in terms of implement this idea. I want to put a chip in my brain, and I want to be able to trigger this somehow. It goes to a computer, and when I get an idea, I think of that idea as going to this source, and it gets recorded. I'd like to know how I can protect some concept of that idea.
Well, it's actually already being done by a group of people. I've heard about them. They're called biohackers. And I would actually do a little research on the internet with your actual fingers on the keyboard first, and look up biohackers.
Have you gotten anywhere with this idea, Lewis?
Yes, I've talked to a neurologist, a couple of head people, and they say that is one great idea. Because I want to tell you quickly, I read about a veteran who lost his arm, and they were able to put a chip in his brain, and he thought about moving his arm, this fake arm that they put on an appendage, and he was able to do it.
Yeah.
And I figured if you could do that, if you could, with the thought process, I'd be able to take my thoughts and be able to encode them someplace.
Interesting.
Well, the protection of the device wouldn't be a matter of copyright law. It would be a matter of patent law.
Yeah. Patent law.
I say keep working on it, though.
Patent law protects functional things. You know, copyright protects non-functional expression. So it would be a patent matter. And you would have to have the thing developed, at least on paper, in order to register.
Okay. I can't just talk it out. All right. I get that. But thank you very much.
Okay, Lewis. Thank you very much. Interesting call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Polly Law is here. Bill Westwood at Paul Rapp. We go to Jody in Cambridge. Jody, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling about, I'm a songwriter, and I do arrangements and things like that, too. And a while ago, a songwriter had me do an arrangement for his song, which I did. He loved it. We recorded it and everything. My question is, can I copyright the arrangement? And I had been told at some point that you have to have permission from the songwriter. If I have to have permission from the songwriter, does it have to be explicit, or can a lack of saying no, you cannot copyright it, be considered permission?
No, you would want to have something in writing that sets out what percentage of the total you get, and you know, and it could be a co-songwriter, it could be, you know, a joint copyright, and you own 20 or 30% and he owns the rest. But
well,
it's something
I didn't write the song or anything about it. I just did the arrangement.
Okay. You know, it's been done, but you do need his permission, and you know, and he should know that having the arrangement done is when that arrangement is performed, you know, he's going to get less of a royalty than he otherwise would, because you would be getting something for the arrangement.
Right. Okay, so it is possible to copyright an arrangement then.
Yes, it is. It's not done a lot, but it is possible, and the copyright laws provide for it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thanks, Jody. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum, and Bill in Niskayuna. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Ray. How are you?
Good. You're on.
Thank you. I have an idea for a business. Basically, what I want to do is I want to go old school and put a group of MP3s together on an MP3 player, and then essentially sell that to taxi drivers. And I was wondering how would I go about doing that so that I don't get in trouble with people who own the music rights and the writing of the music and the performance of the music and all that.
You get their permission and you work out a royalty agreement.
Well, actually, you know, if you bought every MP3 from the
right.
iTunes store or whatever and put that MP3 on each one, I mean, this would be a little labor intensive, but
that's what I'm thinking too.
The first sale doctrine, once you've purchased a copyrighted material, you can do whatever you want.
He can resell it then?
Hmm.
Yeah, there's reselling of digital. There was a case about that where somebody was selling used MP3s, and I don't remember where that went. You might want to find that case and look, because, you know, since you have an MP3 and it's infinitely reproducible.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you say, look, man, I didn't reproduce this. I bought this MP3 and I put this on this MP3 player and I sold it to this cabbie. That sounds like first sale to me.
Then you're all right. And then I have a really catchy name for this business, and I did a trademark search and it came out as Clear, but I haven't registered the trademark because once I did the search, I found that registering the trademark was a lot more expensive than I can afford right now.
Yep.
Where am I on that? I've already published it as my trademark name in a website, but I don't have it registered.
A New York trademark?
Well, you could get a state trademark, which is $50 instead of, you know, $225. And it'll protect you. It'll protect you in the state of New York. But you have to show, you know, actual use, you know, in commerce in order to get these. So, you know, just having a website talking about a product that you are going to be selling at some point is not enough. You actually have to be selling the product and give them a picture of the product with the work on it, or point of purchase, or a website with the ordering information where you can buy it.
And terrific. So, I would love to go ahead and make that step, but I was afraid. Now, where do I find out about getting that trademark from New York State? That sounds great.
It's the Department of State website.
New York Department of State.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck, Bill. We thank you for the call. The Copyright Forum on WAMC, Bill Westwood, Polly Law, and Paul Rapp here to answer your questions. And Dee in Massachusetts. Hello, Dee.
Hi. Thank you so much for being there for us. I have 350 paintings and drawings that have been reduced down to 8.5 by 11, and a plot for 15-page typewritten plot for a children's movie. And I copywrote it on a VA form, and I'm confused as to how protected it is, because I read that you can copyright a treatment but not an idea. So does this constitute a treatment?
Well, you can copyright a script.
It's not a script. It's a 15-page plot that has accompanying drawings.
So it's a treatment.
You could copyright that.
Yeah.
It's copywritten, but is it safe?
Well,
you've registered it, as you said. You registered it, right?
Yes.
You're protected, I would think.
I think so.
Thank you so much, because I was confused as to if it's enough of a treatment, and if it was protected enough. Thank you so much for answering my question.
Paul, you want to follow up here?
Yeah, I mean, the Writers Guild accepts treatments and registers them as treatments, you know, and I think you get stronger protection
probably
through the Writers Guild than you would through the Copyright Office. So I would investigate that.
Is it expensive, the Writers Guild?
I don't think so, but I don't know for sure.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, Dee. Let's go on over to Adam. Adam in Massachusetts, you're next.
Hi there, how you doing today?
Good.
I had a situation where I was working on a creative project. It was my idea. There was some travel involved, interviews and media projects, filming video in far-off places. There was a person behind the camera who was doing the producing of the event, but it was my connections and contacts and my financing of the whole project, and I even owned the equipment. Who would own the copyright later in a case where the person behind the camera decided they would just take all the original source material and claim it as their own and not even give me copies? What's the law look like on that?
Oh,
I think you got a problem.
Yeah, but I think it's your baby from what you said. I mean, this is your intellectual property, and he's pilfering it.
But if he did the shooting
on the caller's cameras and equipment.
But I'm assuming there's no type of contract or written agreement?
Unfortunately, no.
That's where I think.
But did he pay him to do that? I mean, wouldn't that be implicit?
No.
It's not implicit, and Bill's right. I mean, but you know, cinematographers usually work on work for hire basis,
right.
Which is and there's contracts, so they don't pull the kind of thing that
right.
this guy did. But I think, you know, you would have to threaten and hopefully get in front of a judge, you know, and see which way it blows. I mean, it's really going to be fact intensive.
Exactly. But I think from a practical point of view, see what you think, Paul, but I think get the copyright attorney to put some pressure on the guy with a threat of a lawsuit and see if you can't negotiate a settlement, because I fear, based on my own experience, that if you get into a courtroom and the judge asks the question, or the guy's attorney asks the question, well, who did the shooting? If it's this guy, then arguably under the copyright law, he owns the copyright in lieu of a written agreement to the contrary.
Yeah. And the issue would be the amount that Adam was directing.
There's much more than just shooting. I mean, did you edit this and direct everything with it, Adam?
We were collaborating on the editing. Actually, it was a woman behind the camera, and Paul, you actually represented her in this case. We tried going
jeepers,
to court,
creepers.
But I received a threatening phone call a week beforehand.
Right. You know, I was just thinking about her.
Okay, well, this is old home week here on the Vox Pop Copyright Show. Thank you, Adam. We appreciate the call.
This town is getting too small.
This one, you better get out of Dodge. Mike in Pittsfield. Mike, you're on.
Hi there. This question, I'm sure one variation has come up before, but I happen to be friendly with somebody that started a record label back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it's a very sort of small label. We're not talking the Rolling Stones here. And he documented a particular scene of music. And when I got in touch with him after a number of years recently, he was saying that my enthusiasm for the music, he wants to pass it on to somebody. And, you know, I asked him, you know, what he knew about copyright, what kind of contracts he had with the artists, and so forth. And he said, look, it was the 60s. The ethos was, you know, you showed up, you did it, and then, you know, you got some cash, and that was it. So, you know, I don't think anybody has challenged him. Many of the artists are no longer with us. But in my consideration about this with, you know, repressing CDs, maintaining the MP3s, anything other than trying to distribute existing stock would be that I would have artists or the heirs of artists challenge the fact that somebody else had taken this over. And, you know, we're not talking a lot of money here, but I have spoken to people who are interested. It was in Europe, and they wanted to repress some of the albums. And I think it may be going on without his authorization. So in his interest or my involvement, what would you suggest?
You need a formal written agreement with him
about
who has responsibility for this work.
Yeah, I think you would want to have a contract where he devises this to you, whatever interest he has in these recordings, which sounds considerable, and then, put the stuff out. And if somebody's got a problem, there's some risk they'll come find you. But, my friend Bob Irwin, Sundazed Records, I mean, he would find a reel-to-reel tape at a garage sale and listen to it, and it would be like great garage music from the 60s. And sometimes he would put it out and just say, I don't even know who this is, but this is great. He just puts it out and lets the chips fall where they may.
Well, arguably, too, if it was before the current copyright law, if it was in the 60s, then wouldn't it have fallen into the public domain if it had not been registered?
Ooh, that
there's a possibility of that it was not registered, and that anybody that wants to do these things, a lot of Europeans do 1,000 number represses,
right.
Of these things. And my concern is not setting up, an agreement with him and, his wife and so forth, but he has no heirs. And it's not an agreement with him. I think that could be done simply. What my consideration is, if any of the artists are still with us or their heirs coming and challenging, thinking that there was money in it, and there really isn't, but it's something where that's the consideration, sort of impede me from doing this. And I thought, alternatively, going to some of the people I know that were associated with this scene and saying, how about we set up an educational foundation for young musicians? They had a community ethos, and I thought that was one alternative to my putting myself on the line just for the problems.
I don't think you're putting yourself on the line that much. I mean, if none of these people have complained, and the guy you're talking to has already released the stuff, and nobody complained before, so I think you'd be fine.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. We appreciate it very much. We'll move on here, and we'll go over to Dan in Poughkeepsie. Dan, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to put together a theatrical show chronicling the history of rock and roll. Probably be using about 75 songs, and I'm looking to use, like big pop hits, and I'm wondering, what kind of permissions I would need to get to use snippets of hit songs from like the 60s and 70s and whatever.
Are you going to do the original recordings?
No, play live,
so
a verse and a chorus
box
of this song and a verse and chorus of the next song, things of that nature. Just snippets of each song.
Well, depending on how small the snippets are, it's arguably fair use. You're talking about 75, and so that's a lot.
Sure,
that would be like a verse and a chorus of each song.
That's more than a snippet.
That's more than a snippet.
Okay.
You would have to go to the publishers. You'd have to go to the publishers for each song and ask them. And if you're talking about 75, boy, that's going to be a lot.
That wouldn't be covered if the venue has like a BMI or ASCAP license.
No, because it's being incorporated into a theatrical production, so it's that's not the same as a bar band, playing covers in a bar where they would be covered by ASCAP or BMI, but here you're incorporating their work into a greater creative work, and so you would need permissions from all of the publishers.
And do you have any idea what the cost might run on something like that?
Well, they're all going to want some percentage of your. And they all can say no. If they don't think it's a worthwhile project, but they'll all want.
It was like a compulsory license.
There is no compulsory license for something like this. No, and they'll all want a percentage, and they'll all want most favored nations. So they'll all want the same percentage.
They all want top billing.
So if you have 75 songs, you may wind up with not enough percentages.
Right.
Well, you
like
can
the producers.
Yeah.
Like the producers, exactly. And I hope it's a flop.
Yes. 50% for you, 50% for you.
Hey, Dan, thanks a lot. We got to take a break here, but thank you for the call. Polly Law is here. Bill Westwood at Paul Rapp. The number is 800-348-2551. The Copyright Forum will be back. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Copyright Forum. Ray Graff here, and we're joined today by Bill Westwood, Polly Law, and Paul Rapp. The number is 800-348-2551. While we have a minute here, gang, let's get our contact info out, and then we will repeat it at the end of the show. How do people get in touch with the famous Polly Law?
Well, I don't know how they get in touch with her, but they can get in touch with me at pmlaw@buttonwoodart.com.
pmlaw@buttonwoodart.com.
Yes.
Now, Paul Rapp, I assume that you have some contact information you'd like to share.
As a matter of fact, I do.
Okay.
You can reach me at paul@paulrapp.com.
Two P's.
Two P's.
You have your own domain. Well, good for you.
I really pissed off every other Paul Rapp in the world.
Could you not? Don't worry, Zach. Rosemary Armeo would say it on a regular basis.
I've heard it on here.
We try to avoid that sort of language. Thank you. And you know, you're here. Bill Westwood, can you keep it clean?
I'll try to keep it clean. You can reach me at westwood@capital.net.
Okay. Are we all satisfied now?
Is that clean enough?
Yeah, that's very, very. You're the best of the bunch. All right, here we go. And Jillian in Waterville. Jillian, you're on.
Hi, guys. This is really interesting, so thank you. I joined my son's music club at school, and they do concerts, and they would take the recordings and put them on their website for free. They're always looking for fundraising. The possibility of, like, creating a CD that parents could buy or grandparents could buy, they don't like the idea. They told me it would be a copyright violation, and there's all different types of songs, and, of course, it changes with concerts. So, but I don't think anyone ever did any research on that. And they're always fundraising. They're a nonprofit. They give out whatever donations that they get back to kids to have music lessons and scholarships and camps and stuff like that. So is it a possibility or not?
Yes. If for songs, there's what's called a compulsory license. We mentioned it in an earlier phone call where you can go and get a license. You tell them how many copies you're going to make or how many downloads you're going to sell or whether you want to have it streaming. And it's generally it's 9 cents per copy per song.
Is this through the Copyright Clearance Center or ASCAP?
This is through the Harry Fox Agency and their website. You can do it online and just get a click-through license at songfile.com.
Would you have to do that for every concert, every time you made the CD? Because there's a spring concert, a winter, and a fall.
Well, you'd have to do it for every song, certainly.
Okay.
So if you repeated a song at various concerts, you're already covered.
You're probably already covered. And there's a certain honor system to it. I mean, especially if you're a small user, they don't come and say, well, how many of you sold? Prove it, you know. And so, you know,
well, it's a school, though. I don't think they would want to.
Yeah, but that's, you know, I'm a little concerned about putting this stuff up on the web. If you're putting it on YouTube, it's going to be subject to getting yanked down, I think, very often. If you put it up on the school website, and it's still infringement. You know, you probably won't get caught. Mm-hmm. You probably won't get caught right away, but the stuff should be behind some kind of a password-protected environment, you know, to be really
safe.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah, it's right on the school website.
All right.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks, Jillian, not Julian. Over to Tim in Albany. Tim, you're on.
Hello. Well, thanks for taking my call. I have an interesting question about reproducing buildings. I want to 3D print some historical buildings downtown, and one of them in particular has a animal on top of it that is trademarked, so I didn't know what took precedent there, and if I could do it, and if I did, if somebody would come after me, or how I would pay for licensing fees or something like that.
Are you doing this for commercial purposes?
I would like to, yes. Right now I'm just doing it for fun, but my friends really like it, and they have a pretty good process. So I didn't know what issues I would run into if I tried to sell them for money.
I think you're good to go, and we're talking about Nipper.
Yeah.
And when the city of Albany did their Nipper thing last year, they called me, and I researched the history of Nipper, which is kind of fascinating.
Yep.
But you're not using it in a trademark sense. You're reproducing a landmark. Famous landmark in the city of Albany.
So, put the name there if I had, because I could put like a base on it and put a little display type of mini, it has his name on it.
You can reproduce it any way you want. You don't have to credit them at all. It's not a trademark use that you're putting it to the extent they have any more trademarks.
Does anyone still own that? The RCA?
I'm trying to remember,
dog?
But I mean, I told the city go ahead because they're not going to. You know, I mean, it's got this really labored, unbelievable history, and it's not clear that anybody now in the United States has any trademark rights to Nipper. So
quickly on that, because I noticed, I'm not an expert, but I did a quick search and I found, I want to say it was as early as 2014, and somebody in like Australia tried to use a likeness of Nipper, I want to say for like a dog washing and it looked like Nipper, and then it looked like it got taken down by some, you know, extension of RCA. So I didn't know if that was applicable or, you know, different, I guess.
That's different because they were using it for a trademark use. They were using it to promote a dog washing, and you're just using it as art. And
it's an artifact.
And an artifact.
Yeah.
So
okay, wow.
Well, thanks, Tim. We appreciate the call. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. I'm looking at my screen that has all the calls on it, and one of them has a yellow triangle with an exclamation point, and I've never seen that before.
Is that the
flash flood warning?
Frankly, it's terrifying me. Let's go to that call. Deborah in Saratoga County. Deborah, you're on.
Wow. I didn't know I got an asterisk.
I don't know what that means.
It's a triangle.
Don't say anything bad, because Paul's already done that.
Yeah.
No. It's just that the lady that I was talking to, I said this is a similar call to some of the others.
Let's just clear something up right away.
Sure.
Is this a case that already involves Paul?
No.
Okay, good.
We're all safe.
All right, well, fine.
I can say that 100% because I know the two people. And he's not one of them.
All right.
Okay.
Let's try not to mention any specific names, and let's carry on, Deborah.
Right. Okay. My husband and another person created a program. His intellectual property, and the other is all the administration of getting it up and running, of booking places. It is presented. It was created in 2003. It's presented to nonprofit and profit groups and organizations. It's workshops, what they are. And the other individual registered it and omitted my husband in any of it.
Uh-huh.
His name isn't anywhere, and it's his intellectual property and his equipment.
Okay.
And now what?
Well, that can be challenged certainly in court. I mean, getting a trademark registration or a copyright trademark registration, isn't the government agreeing with you that you own something? It's them accepting your sworn statement
that you
own
first.
Something, and that's rebuttable. Unfortunately, it's only rebuttable in a court of law, and things can get, you know, pretty dicey and pretty expensive really fast. But that's your avenue of relief. He should probably register the thing himself in his name.
Hmm.
The Copyright Office doesn't run around and look and see if somebody else has registered the same thing. They just look at it and say, is this the kind of thing we register? And if it is, they register.
But what happens when it comes to blows and then they say, well, this one was registered 2 years before the other one?
That's when you go to court.
Yeah. Okay. It's not a race to the Copyright Office. So.
Deborah, thanks a lot. And, you know, I don't know why there was an exclamation point there. It was perfectly fine, right? What could go wrong? Well, let's find out.
The machine is enraged by her story.
Oliver where are you calling from, Oliver?
Calling from Rhinebeck.
Okay, it says Glinebeck here, but I'll call it Rhinebeck. How you doing?
I'm a little disappointed I don't have a exclamation point.
That's all right.
So I guess I want to present you with a hypothetical. If someone buys on eBay or finds in a thrift store a vernacular photograph, an unauthored photograph, an old photograph, they don't know who took it. And then they upload that photograph or a group of those photographs onto the internet. Can someone else download those and use them for any purpose, including making a book, selling that book?
Yeah.
It's in the public domain.
Yeah, and you don't acquire any kind of rights, you know, copyrights by just purchasing the photograph.
So if you didn't take the photograph, but you simply bought it, you can't claim copyright. Now, what if let's say you download a bunch of these photographs, you curate them into some kind of a creative grouping, and then you publish a book of those.
Mm-hmm.
Can someone then take the images from that book and use those without needing to get permission?
If they were in the public domain when they were selected for the book, they are still in the public domain in the book.
They couldn't take your entire collection, though.
Right, and
that
the
was
text.
The book and the text and reproduce that, but they could take individual images out of that book and use them because they're still in the public domain.
All right.
So, but if you, I'm sorry, one quick extension of this. If you manipulate that image in such a way, can you make it your own somehow that you can put a copyright on it?
You own the manipulations. You would own the changes that you put on. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Oliver. Thanks a lot for the call. Over to Philip in Saratoga Springs. Philip, you're on.
Well, thank you. My question is basically simple. I'm a graphic designer at times, and I might design a T-shirt for sale in someone's store, but yet if they never utilize that design, can I then take it and sell it to someone else? I did indeed sell it to them. They paid me for my time. There is no contract. There's no agreement that says I won't use it elsewhere. Can I take that design and sell it to someone else, albeit next door, if I wanted to?
Yes, certainly. But I think for your own protection, you should register that image, and you should also have a contractual agreement with whomever you're dealing with that states that, you know, they're getting a certain usage of it. And then beyond that, you have the right to reuse it however you want.
And be ready for the guy next door to be mad with you.
Right.
Oh, no, that I'm well prepared for. Okay, that was as simple as it gets.
Well, thanks, Philip. We appreciate a simple call here on a simple program. Michelle in Capital Region. Michelle, you're on.
Hi. My call is about a defensible copyright. We're talking probably over 20 years ago. I had come up for a design with a piece of jewelry, wrote a verbal description for it, and got pictures and submitted it, and got the registration for the copyright. And in the meantime, I came across a catalog for a museum shop that came out with something that if you go against the verbal description, it's like spot on. But the design or the actual image is a little bit different, but close enough at a distance. Do I have a defensible copyright?
It depends.
The written description is an idea.
Right. That's,
But it's not the physical manifestation for the idea, of the idea, which is the only thing that you can copyright.
I mean, there is a possibility of independent creation, too. If they didn't copy your work but came up with this jewelry design on their own, they're good to go.
That didn't work for George Harrison.
It worked for a case I was working on until 2 weeks ago. But
here we go.
But,
again.
You know, I mean, and Harrison was, found liable because of unconscious copying because he couldn't deny that he hadn't heard
My sweet.
All right.
Yeah. But it's certainly worth looking into and talking to the museum store about where they got this from and who did it and doing a little research. Because it sounds like, you know, your jewelry's been out there in the world. It may well have been knocked off.
Okay. Because if it's a cast piece, like I have the original casting, but because I had it done someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Their casting does look different, but again, it's more the concept and the look.
Well, it's also if they created a derivative image from yours, or I would think would be actionable potentially.
I think so.
Is it the same casting company?
No.
Oh. Mm. Okay.
No, I don't know if they use the same casting company. Okay. It's possible because it is a firm that is in their area.
Well, I think you have to do some research and just find out what the provenance of the museum store's jewelry was, where it came from,
and then show it to a good copyright attorney and discuss the possibilities. I've had derivative images made from some of my work and. You know, it's a little dicier than going after an original piece that's been directly copied, but it's possible, I think.
Well, thank you for the call. We go over now to Brandon in Clifton Park. Brandon, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. So I'm a recent law school graduate, actually, and one of the things I really studied and specialized in school was copyrights, trademarks, and other intellectual property law. So right now I actually have an article that's forthcoming in an academic journal that discusses the recent Ninth Circuit decision in Lenz v. Universal Music, which dealt with fair use in the context of online copyright takedowns from sites like YouTube. I was just wondering, just as a curiosity, I turned the show on. I couldn't pass this opportunity up. If anyone has any experience with sort of DMCA takedowns or like online copyright uses, and any thoughts you have on maybe the Lenz
decision. Okay, we're almost out of time. Yeah. So go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm not sure I'm familiar with that case. What was the case again? Universal?
Lenz v. Universal Music. Okay. It's been an ongoing case for about 7 years.
At the 10 seconds.
I thought you were going to talk about the Blurred Lines case. Yeah, without knowing more details, I really can't. But I've got tons of experience with that stuff, and you know, and DMCA is a DMCA, and
right.
You know, unfortunately, I mean, this is something that Ray sent me. You know, in Europe now they're putting more and more onus on the website operator to filter stuff, and it's just going to mean less stuff is up, you know, on online, and then that's really a shame, and hopefully it doesn't happen here.
All right, we're about out of time here. Quickly, let's get our contact information again. Bill Westwood.
Westwood at capital.net.
Paul at paulrapp.com.
PM Law at buttonwoodart.com.
Well, thank you all for being here. Support comes from Merritt Bookstore, Millbrook, an independent book and toy store in the heart of Millbrook, welcomes Walter Keady with his newest novel, The Priests of Cranmore, Saturday, September 29th at noon, merrittbooks.com. Transitions in Mayfield, New York, working to support young adults with autism and other learning differences with college, careers, and independent living, transitionsusa.org. Patricia Dalton Fennell and Albany Health Management Associates, working locally and globally, announcing the Restorative Practices Phase Project for mental health caregiving professionals, albanyhealthmanagement.com. And Studio KTM Salon Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color, from corrective to fashion, by stylist Kristen Marquette, studiokTM.com. Thanks again to Bill Westwood, Polly Law, and Paul Rapp for being here today. Thank you for joining us and for some great calls. Thanks to our engineer, Zachy Sandwich. Thanks to Jesse King, who took the calls today. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Dr. Carrie O'Loughlin returns for Pets and Vets. Stand by now for news.